Such a pretty afternoon. If I weren't giving the Dharma talk today, I think I would have played hooky. So the title of the talk is, Whom Are You Looking For? In the late 1960s, early 1970s, there was an American who had gone to India. His name was Richard Alpert. And he was interested in Buddhist practice, and he'd found Buddhist teachers. He had a Hindu friend, and Hindu friend said, come, I want you to meet my guru. And so Richard was willing to do that, and they borrowed another friend's Land Rover, and they drove to see the guru. And his friend, when they got there, was so excited to see his guru that he rushed up the hill to see him, and he prostrated at his feet and was just bowing to the guru's feet. And Richard Alpert was just totally nonplussed by this. He just did not, this was not the kind of devotion that he was used to. And so he made his way up the hill and was introduced to the guru, and the guru said, is that your car? And Richard said, no, that's not my car. I borrowed it from a friend. And the guru said, how much did it cost? And he told him about what he thought it cost. And then the guru said, can I have it? And Richard Alpert had come from this New Haven Jewish family, and he said, I knew the Jewish shakedown, you know. I knew how this could happen. And he said, this guy was a professional. And so the guru said, you know, why don't you have something to eat? And Richard Alpert was just extremely uncomfortable with this whole scene. And afterwards, after he had eaten, the guru said, come sit down. And he said, you were out under the stars last night. And Richard Alpert said, yes, I was. And he said, and you were thinking about your mother. And Richard Alpert said, yes, I was. And he said, your mother died last year. And Richard Alpert is thinking, how does this guy know this? And then the guru said, her stomach got very big. And he's saying all this in Hindi, and he's being translated for Richard Alpert. And now Richard Alpert is really spooked out. And then the guru says in English, spleen. And his mother had died of cancer of the spleen. And I want to read you what he says about what happened then. He said, my mind went faster and faster trying to figure out how he could know all this. My rational mind just gave up. It went like poof. At that same moment, there was a violent wrenching, a very painful pull in my chest, and I started to cry. Later, I realized it was my fourth chakra, the heart center, opening. I looked up at Maharaji, and he was looking back at me with total love. I realized he knew everything about me, even the things I was most ashamed of, and yet he wasn't judging me. He was just loving me with pure, unconditional love. I cried and I cried and I cried and I cried. I wasn't sad and I wasn't happy. The closest I can say is that I was crying because I was home. I had carried my big load up the hill, and now it was all done. The journey was over, and I had finished my search. All that paranoia washed out of me, and everything else too. I was left with just a feeling of fantastic love and peace. I was in the living presence of Maharaji's unconditional love. I had never been loved so completely. From that moment on, all I wanted was to touch Maharaji's feet. So Maharaji is Neem Karoli Baba, and Richard Alpert is Ram Dass. That was the name that Maharaji would give him later on, which means servant of God. There's this moment of recognition energy when the teacher recognizes you. And in this sense of being seen, of being recognized, there is this recognition of the teacher. It's this mutual recognition that's just dancing back and forth. We see the same kind of recognition energy in the New Testament. There's another story about being at the teacher's feet. You know this story? It's the story of the woman who is a woman of the city. It's the way she's named, and she's traditionally thought of as Mary Magdalene. And she comes, and Jesus is at dinner, and she comes, and she kneels at his feet, and she's just weeping. She's just weeping. And she's at his feet, and she's bathing his feet with her tears, and she's wiping the wetness off of his feet with her hair. And then she anoints his feet with this very costly oil. It's a moment of pure devotion. She has felt seen by this teacher. She knows him as her teacher. She sees him, she recognizes him. What's up with Neem Karoli Baba knowing all this stuff about Richard Alpert, Ram Dass? How's he know all this stuff? You know, this is something that happened in the last century. This wasn't 10 or 20 centuries ago. This kind of thing goes on in the New Testament too, doesn't it? Jesus knows stuff. You know, he knows, like, well, I know who's going to betray me. And I'm Peter, I know that actually you'll deny me three times. And I know that I'll be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes. He knows things. He knows things about himself. He knows things about other people. How do you make sense of things like this? There's a teacher I've mentioned her before. Her name is Deepa Ma. She was a little Bengali woman who suffered tremendous losses. She lost her husband and I think two of her children. And she was dying of grief. And she had been, I think, in her bed for maybe a couple of years at this point. And her doctor said, I think you're going to die. And I want you to go to the temple and learn to meditate. And so she literally crawls up the steps of the temple in Rangoon, and she learns to meditate, but she's a natural. She is an adept, and she is able to achieve deep states of concentration. And in these concentration states, in these jhanic states, all kinds of unusual things can happen. Precognition and clairaudience. And one of the things that she really blew people away by doing was U Thant, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was giving a talk. I think it was his inaugural talk at the UN. And Deepa Ma time traveled, and she went back and she told her friends what he was going to say. And he said it all word for word. How does this happen? You may not be curious about this, but I am. So when I was, those of you who've been here recently have heard me talk about being with my teacher, Philip Moffitt, in his teaching about these different nine levels of consciousness, these nine bodies of awakening. And this is a map which helps me make sense of these sorts of phenomena. So these nine bodies are grouped into three groups of three. They're the sort of the manifest bodies. And that's what we were working with in the meditation tonight. This physical body being supported, resting down on the earth and resting back in the breathing. That's all physical body. And this sense of vitality, we did this last week too, this sense of vitality in the body, this is the so-called vital body. And then there's an emotional body. We did some with that last week. All this is we're all familiar with all this. Physical and vital and emotional body. You know, when you're going through a really difficult time, if you're in a period of great grief, your vitality can be just totally drained from you. That's what happened to Deepa Ma. She just lost her vitality. But through her meditative practice, she was able to recapture this vitality and more. So the next three levels, our next three bodies up are the so-called subtle bodies, and they're the etheric body and the astral body and the intuitional body. And the etheric body is simply luminous consciousness. It's what happens when we turn and look at, it's like turning and looking at the projector in a movie theater. It's like, what is lighting all this business up? And it's the light of the projector. And it's the same thing in the mind. It's the light of the mind, it's consciousness itself, that's lighting everything up. And when we turn and look at this luminous consciousness itself, this is the womb of healing for that which ills the first three bodies, the physical body and the vital body and the emotional body. It's said in this teaching that this etheric body is like a womb. Just as a baby is held in her mother's womb, and there's the heartbeat of the baby and there's the heartbeat of the mother, these first three bodies are held in the womb of this this subtle etheric body. And the way we access it is through being aware of these little sparkles and these tingles in the body, and we ask, what is it that knows these? What is it that's aware of these? So some of this is review for you, for those of you who were here last week. When you are in the presence of someone who is working out of, speaking out of this etheric body, there is a sense of being held in this great compassionate energy. If you know the phrase, the Akashic field is that which all knowledge is held there. The Jungians would call it the collective unconscious. It is the collective that knows everything. In this Akashic field, there is enormous healing potential. And Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's teacher, like Jesus, like the Buddha, was known as a healer of non-ordinary capacities in his time. The next level up, and this is the one that I really wanted to get to, is the so-called astral level. And this is the level where the formless beings reside. You know, in our 21st century Western scientific mindset, science is the dominant myth for our time. There's no such thing as this astral level. Earlier generations have had no problem with this, and so the reality of angels and archangels and devas and our loved ones who are not embodied in physical form anymore. These were very available. When Ram Dass knows these things about, Maharaj-ji knows these things about Ram Dass's mother, he's operating out of this level. This is a universal human capacity. We all can access this. We simply have to be taught. This is not taught in most Sunday schools. So much of what you get in contemporary religious teaching is really first half of life stuff. It's really mostly about do this, don't do that, you know, keep these rules, do this, stay away from that. And that's important stuff for us when we're growing up. We need that. But in the second half of life, it's pretty thin gruel. And we need access to these different dimensions, what go under the rubric we would generally call spiritual. My teacher Philip Moffat says that if you're going to hang out in or learn about any of these nine bodies, the one to really hang out in or to know about is this fourth body, the etheric body. Because there is so much healing for these first three bodies, the emotional body and the vital body and the physical body, in this simply turning and looking at consciousness itself, at luminous consciousness. I had really stumbled on this for myself with the help of some Tibetan teachers. And so I knew when Philip said, investigate this luminous consciousness, I knew he was speaking that I knew for myself to be true. I was having a conversation with Philip afterwards, and I said, Philip, you know, I think I've got fairly easy access to this etheric body. And I said, but, you know, I don't really think I've got all that much access to this kind of non-ordinary disembodied stuff. The astral body is where near-death experiences happen. It's where out-of-body experiences happen. I said, I don't think I've really got very much access to that. He said, oh no, Gordon, you're wrong about that. It was arresting for me to hear that from him. So, all this is prelude to what I want to talk about, which is the dedication of the garden in my wife Kathy's memory this Sunday at St. Mary's. My dear friend Tom Ward, whom I've known for 35 years, and we've been brothers in arms as Episcopal priests. I did Tom's son's funeral earlier this year, and so he'll be doing the dedication of this garden. And we were talking about it's just going to be a little 15 or 20 minute thing, but we were talking about what we wanted to have included in it. And there's a poem by Wendell Berry called I Go Among Trees. Kathy read this at our wedding in the Japanese garden at Cheekwood. And it's just a perfect little poem, and we'll read that. And there's a particular psalm that she liked. And then Tom said, and I thought this was really inspired, he said, I've been thinking about Jesus' encounter with Mary Magdalene in the garden on Easter morning. You know, the crucifixion takes place nearby this garden, and Jesus' body is taken down and it's put in this tomb that's been hewn out of rock, and nobody has ever been in this. Nobody has ever been in this tomb before. And so, you know, it's kind of the beginning of the Sabbath, and there's not time to anoint his body. They just leave his body in the tomb, and the Sabbath is a quiet day, no work on that day. And then Sunday morning they come to anoint his body, and they don't find a body. And Mary is just, she's weeping in the garden. And there's this man who asks her, "Why are you weeping?" And she thinks it's the gardener. It's in the garden, she thinks it's the gardener. And she says, "They've taken," she just thinks the body has been stolen. She says, "They've taken my Lord, and I don't know where they've taken him." And he simply says her name. He just says, "Mary." And that recognition energy, that recognition moment happens. And she sees who it is. And she says, "Rabboni," which means teacher in Aramaic. She sees her teacher. It's one of, I think it's maybe the most intimate moment in the whole New Testament. They clearly love each other. They are devoted to each other. And I think that's one of the reasons that Tom thought this would be a good reading for us on Sunday. I want to read you what Adyashanti has to say about this encounter. This is Adyashanti's book called Resurrecting Jesus. I've kind of talked about this chapter by chapter some time back. I think it's one of the most thoughtful, non-scholarly, but thoughtful pieces about the inner life of Jesus. And Adyashanti, you know, who's come out of this Zen background, says that Jesus has been an important figure for him all during his growing up and his subsequent development as a teacher. And he says, you know, I'm not out there selling Buddhism. I'm not selling anything. I'm not selling any religion. If I'm selling anything, it's waking up. It's waking up to who you really are. Waking up to this same unconditional love that Ram Dass felt from Maharaji. So here's Adyashanti. "Maybe you can feel the deep simplicity in how Mary Magdalene turns and says, 'Teacher, teacher.' There's such warmth there, such a beautiful and simple intimacy. And as teacher, the next thing that Jesus says to her is, 'Don't cling to me.' This is his final teaching to her. This is his way of saying, 'Don't try to hold on to me. Don't desire me, but remember your true nature. Your nature is sacred love. Your nature is divine being. Remember that, and you won't need to cling to me.'" It's another intimate response by which he orients her one last time, one little bit, so that she doesn't cling. It's his final teaching to her, and that intimate moment of her reconnecting with him is almost like reconnecting with a beloved, or like reconnecting with God when you think God is gone. He's died, and yet now, there he is. They have this short but intense encounter in which he realigns her with her deeper nature. And in the end, her nature, to love much, is what saves her. Though reoriented toward its higher form of divine, non-clinging, selfless love. Now, I want to interrupt this reading from Adyashanti to make a point. And that is, In the classical understanding, the resurrection body of Jesus is not a resuscitated corpse. Let me say that again. It is not a resuscitated corpse. It is a different kind of body. This is, to use the map I've been talking with you about, this is his astral body. Okay? He has an astral body. So do you, and you, and you. Everyone does. I have a good friend. She's a minister. And sometime after her mother died, her mother appeared to her in the astral body. Now, my minister friend is, I mean, she is anything but hysteric. I mean, you know, she is like one of these solid feet on the ground kind of people. She is not prone to visions. But she had this experience with her mother, and she said, I cannot tell you how healing this was for me. And they stood and they embraced each other. Now, I want to let you know, I've never had anything close to that kind of experience. But I do trust the testimony of certain people whom I know. Back to Ajashanti. Mary is a reminder that it doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what you've gone through in life. It doesn't matter what you think about yourself. It doesn't matter what you feel about yourself. Everyone is redeemable. Everyone can turn around and hit the mark. Everyone can reorient toward divine being. No one need waste a moment in guilt about the past, for Jesus didn't even imagine Mary as someone unredeemable. He immediately aligned her with her state of openness and receptivity. And now here she is, she's weeping again, because she can't find Jesus. And so he says to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" And I love what he says next. He says, "Whom are you seeking?" He knows whom she's seeking. Why would Jesus ask her this question? It's as if he's saying, "Mary, remember, there's nothing outside yourself to seek." What are you doing? What are you seeking? Otherwise, there would be no reason for him to ask the question, because he already knows the answer. So again, his question offers her a subtle reminder, as if to say, it's all within you. The kingdom of heaven is within you. The redeeming presence is within you. You are infinitely more than you ever imagined yourself to be. What are you doing? Who are you looking for? It's all inside you. Now I'm going to break in here into my narrative and say, to actually discover, not just his head knowledge. You know, it's one thing to say, oh, it's all inside you, and say, okay, yeah, the kingdom of heaven is within you. But to actually experience this for yourself, this is what our meditative practice is about. It's not just about stress reduction. Stress reduction is fine, and I am all for it. I ain't got nothing against it. But our practice is aiming at something deeper. It's aiming at this remembering our true nature. Buddhists would call it Buddha nature. There's a phrase in Buddhism that's called Tathagatagarbha. Tathagatagarbha. And it means the womb of the Buddhas. What Jesus is doing with Mary Magdalene is he's taking her into this womb of compassion, so that she will know herself. Back to Aja. The life of Mary is a reminder that it doesn't matter what anyone's done. In the realm of divine being, nothing is important except the ability to recognize divinity when it shows up and respond to it with all your heart. In fact, the shame Mary first felt in the presence of Jesus may have made her available to recognize and respond to the divine presence when she came upon it. And so it is with most human beings' lives. We don't make the greatest leaps of consciousness when we're feeling great and everything is lovely and life is going our way. We often make the greatest leaps of consciousness through the moments of tragedy, through difficulty, through shame, through being stretched to the very limit. Why? Because that's when we're open and available. Our options have fallen away, and at the end of the day, there are really only two options left. Simply to open yourself and surrender your holding, or to suffer some more. Cynthia Bourgeau has a magisterial book on Mary Magdalene. It ought to be required reading for everybody in the Christian church. And she's got this formula, which I want to give you because I think it really helps to understand what is going on in Mary Magdalene's life. And, you know, the reason we read these stories is because their stories are our stories. You know, the story of Jesus is the story of you and me and those we love. The story of the Buddha is my story. The story of Mary Magdalene is my story, your story. So the formula is this. A equals E times K. That requires some unpacking. A stands for agape. Agape is the Greek word for love. It's one of the Greek words for love. But it's this love that is non-possessive, non-clinging. It's that love that doesn't depend on being loved back. It is just this wide open, non-clinging, non-possessive love. A, agape, equals E, and E is eros. And eros is what attaches us to each other. Yes, it's erotic love, it's sexual love, but it's that love that makes me want to be with you, makes you want to be with me. It's that deep sense of connection that we have. It's romantic love, to be sure, but it's that love that holds on. A equals E times K. K is the kind of technical word. The word is kenosis. It's translated in the New Testament as emptying. But for our purposes, let's say that K is letting things be. So, agape, non-possessive love, is possessive love that is allowed to be the way it is. You know, there's a possessive love which is essentially unconscious. It's just grasping. It's just grasping, you know. And Mary Magdalene, of course, when she sees the risen Jesus in his astral body, in his resurrection body, you know, she wants, God, you're back. You know, she wants to get her arms around it. And he says, this is his last teaching, he says, let your erotic love be here. Let this eros be here. But just let it be. Just let it be. Be conscious of it. Allow it. And what happens when you do that is you move into this etheric body. You move into this body which is not trying to possess anything. In the etheric body, everyone that you have ever loved and that has loved you is there. They're there. Your grandmother is there. Your teacher whom you loved is there. Your dog is there too. Just to put a fine point on it. Everyone that you have loved is there. But the way we access this is by recognizing our fierce human desire to hold on and how difficult it is to let go. This is not about letting go. It's not about trying to let go. It's about noticing how much we want and letting the energy of that be. Because this is a nuclear furnace of love. This is like a star. It's a furnace inside. When we just let that love be, then it transmutes, it transforms into something else. When Jesus goes up on a high mountain with Peter and James and John, and he's transfigured into the pure divine radiance, and they fall on their feet because he is so bright, he has become one with this kind of love. And it's an overwhelming experience. So I want to read you what Ram Dass says about this. And I think he writes knowledgeably about this. Imagine feeling more love from someone than you have ever known. You're being loved more than your mother loved you when you were an infant. More than you were ever loved by your father, your child, your most intimate lover, anyone. This lover doesn't need anything from you, isn't looking for personal gratification, only wants your complete fulfillment. You're loved just for being who you are, just for existing. You don't have to do anything to earn it. Your shortcomings, your lack of self-esteem, physical perfection, or social and economic success, none of that matters. No one can take this love away from you. It will always be here. Imagine that being in this love is like relaxing endlessly into a warm bath that surrounds and supports your every movement, so that every thought and every feeling is permeated by it. You feel as though you were dissolving into it. This love is actually part of you. It's always flowing through you. It's like the subatomic texture of the universe, the dark matter that connects everything. When you tune into that flow, you will feel it in your own heart. Not your physical heart or your emotional heart, but your spiritual heart. The place you point to in your chest when you say, I am. This is your deeper heart, your intuitive heart. It's the place where the higher mind, pure awareness, and the subtler emotions, and your soul identity all come together and you connect to the universe where patience and love are. Unconditional love really exists in each of us. It is part of our deep inner being. It's not so much an active emotion as a state of being. It's not, I love you for this reason or that, not, I love you if you love me. It's love for no reason, love without an object. It's just sitting in love. A love that incorporates the chair and the room and permeates everything around. The thinking mind is extinguished in this love. If I go into the place where in myself that is love and you go into the place in yourself that's love, we are together in love. Then you and I are truly in love, the state of being love. That's the entrance to oneness. That's the space I entered when I met my guru. he goes on to talk, and I won't read this, about how his teacher showed him the possibility of transforming personal love, and Ram Dass uses the word into impersonal love. I think it's really transpersonal love. It's beyond the ego. It's beyond our ordinary consciousness. Again, this is a different level of consciousness. I think a number of you saw that in the months before Kathy died, she was living in this consciousness. And it was luminous. It was absolutely luminous. This is a human possibility. And it's a possibility that's here for you, and you don't have to wait till you're dying to access this. Remember the formula. This transpersonal love, this agape, it comes from the recognition of the strong desire of clinging. In the months, first couple of years following Kathy's death, I'd have done anything to get her back. But it was only in learning how to let that strong clinging energy be, that something could shift into this more transpersonal love where there's no place that she's not. We will scatter her last ashes there in this garden on Sunday as a sign of her presence, but she's no less present, no more present anyplace else. Something else I want to say. I'm not quite sure what it is. There is this love that is inside in each one of us. Think about who you have loved in this life. Think about who you love. Those persons may be here available to you. They may not be available to you. As long as we are focused on the out there is that kind of love, which is a good and human kind of love. But when we turn around and look back at the love itself, there's the person out there, there's the love itself. When we turn and look at the love itself, then we're making contact with that divine love, which holds everything and everybody. Nobody deserves it. Nobody has to win it. It's just there. The shortcut to this transpersonal divine love is this seeing through the heart that we've been talking about for some months. Again, if you want to throw out everything that I've said so far this afternoon, just remember, look from the eyes of the heart. And that's the way that you feel deeply, deeply, deeply connected, but not grasping. And there's such freedom in that. There is such freedom. That's the gift of the gospel. That's the gift of the Dharma. It's freedom from this grasping and this open-handed loving presence. That's all I've got to say. So let's sit for a minute. So think of someone for whom you deeply care, who you love. And turn back to this love that is inside you. Let yourself look at them through the eyes of the heart. And say to them, may you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. The same loving kindness that is in me. May you be calm and peaceful. May you be safe and happy. And may you awaken to the beauty of your true nature and be free. Free from clinging, free from grasping. And imagine them saying right back to you, looking at you from the eyes of their heart with open hands, not clinging, may you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful. May you be safe and happy. May you awaken to the beauty of your true nature and be free. And so we send these same wishes rippling around the room to one another. And rippling out from this space into the neighborhood around us. And into the whole city, the whole state, the whole country, the whole world, into the visible and invisible realms, may you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May all beings be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. And may all beings awaken to the beauty of their true nature, this loving awareness, and be free. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of love and joy and happiness, and to the ending of suffering. So just a couple of quick announcements. Since I'll be away this Sunday, I will not be leading the contemplative Eucharist that happens fourth Sundays at St. Augustine's on the Vanderbilt campus. I think somebody else will be celebrating that service, but I won't be there. And the 5 o'clock group that meets at my home on Sunday evenings won't meet either. Kimpo is here in town speaking at Unity Church to... Tibetan Kenpo is here tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, I believe. Right. So, and I try to come here on Wednesdays about 5 o'clock. If anybody wants just meditation instructions beforehand, you're welcome to come earlier. If you just want a longer sit, I'm here around 5 o'clock. So, thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your generous listening, your generosity in the baskets at back, in the back, and in the support button online. And have a lovely week. See you next week.